This is the Tax Update for New Year's Eve, December 31st, 2007. This podcast, Class Warfare in the Family. The Tax Update podcast intended for tax professionals is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and supporting documents may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the supporting audio file. Such prohibited use include using the podcast or document as part of a CPE presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Be sure to visit them on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. This week, we're going to take a look at a case that deals with something that we run into from time to time, that is, a dispute among shareholders. And even better in this case, it appears to be a family-level dispute among shareholders. And finally, just to make it better, we have an S corporation in the middle of this and a shareholder who is working to actively attempt to make sure we don't have an S corporation in this case, or claiming that we never had one, or at least hadn't had one for over a decade. The case in question is a case of Minton versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2007-372. Now, I figure it's kind of a good time to get working up and getting ready for the new year, because all of us are getting ready. You're either listening to this just before the year turns or listening to us here as we enter into 2008, perhaps returning to your offices following New Year's Day festivities, or maybe even listening to it on New Year's Day, though hopefully you found some other things to keep you occupied on New Year's Day aside from listening to this podcast. But if you're listening, we'll go along and accept that. I got this case. We took a look at it because it was kind of an interesting case. And as many of you are probably aware, I spent a lot of time this past year doing continuing education courses of various sorts, or at least spent a number of days doing it. And the courses I did on various topics, but a thing I kept coming back to are pass-through entities, especially S corporations and partnerships. And this particular case deals with some unique issues that are important for S corporations, as well as going back to an issue that we've discussed a couple of times here on this particular podcast, and that is the problem of a taxpayer attempting to argue for a different reality than the structure of a transaction they were involved in, and their difficulties in the uphill fight in trying to make that position for the taxpayer. Now, this particular case, the key issue in this case is whether an agreement between the corporation and its founders, when his children took over the business in the corporation, created a second class of stock, which was a prohibited situation for the S corporation, and in theory would have terminated the S election if, in fact, a second class of stock was found to exist. What's really interesting in this case is it is actually the taxpayer in this case, the individual who is filing the case, in this case, Linda Minton, who is attempting to argue that the S corporation that she is a shareholder in is not really an S corporation, had not been one for over a decade. And the IRS is the one arguing that no, in fact, it was a valid S corporation. There was no second class of stock issue in play. And we have to look at this in the context of why would a shareholder be trying to argue this way to convert it into a C corporation for a corporation that she owned 50% of? Well, when you're in the middle of a shareholder lawsuit, when you're in the middle of a family dispute as well, sometimes people argue for things or try to get results that may seem contrary to their interests, but at times it may be the most important point in some of these cases is what seems to be contrary to the interests of the other parties. And in this particular case, the question became whether, in fact, Linda needed to report the pass-through income for the years in question, as well as whether the entity had truly been an S corporation. Now, first, before we get to this point, it's pretty easy to remember to take a look at the general rules to be eligible to elect S treatment. And the general requirements are found at 1361B1, which defines what an eligible corporation is going to be. And that corporation is one that has no more than 100 shareholders, that does not have any disqualified shareholder, that is, some entity other than a person, an estate, a certain trust, and certain exempt organizations, who is, you know, those cannot be part of the shareholders, does not have a non-resident alien as a shareholder, and finally, has only a single class of stock. Now, the last issue is going to be the one that Linda's going to call into question in this case. And so the question becomes, where do we find the definition for what constitutes a single class of stock? And Regulation 1.1361 1L2i provides the general definition, and that's reproduced in the materials, and I'll go through it briefly here, that the determination of whether all the outstanding shares of stock confer identical rights to distribution and liquidation proceeds is made based on applicable corporate charter, articles of incorporation, bylaws, applicable state laws, binding agreements relating to distribution and liquidation proceeds, collectively called the governing provisions. Now, it's important to remember our key question when we look at whether we have two classes of stock is, do all classes of stock confer identical rights as regards liquidations and distribution? If we liquidate the corporation, is that going to go on a per share basis? And is the rights to distributions conferred on a per share basis? Now, it goes on to discuss that, in fact, although a corporation is not treated as having more classes of stocks, as long as the governing provisions provide for identical distribution liquidation rights, any distributions, including active, constructive, or deemed distributions that differ in timing or amount, are to be given an appropriate tax effect in accordance with the facts and circumstances. Key issue to remember here is that the mere fact that we have distributions that occurred at different times does not by itself create a second class of stock, so long as the rights for all shareholders are identical. If everybody has identical rights to distributions, and all rights to distributions, considering all facts and circumstances, including any agreements or other arrangements that may exist between the shareholders, if all rights are identical, then we have one class of stock, even if, in fact, the distributions did not go out on a per-share basis, let's say in the current year, or, you know, if that has happened maybe over a couple of years, we've gotten out of sync on our amount of distributions. Now, in the course I taught recently, Current Federal Tax Developments Manuals, in the manual that I taught from that was put out by Mayors Nichols CPE, who I do most of my lectures for, there we reference letter rulings 2007-30009 and 2007-23025 that both dealt with situations where S Corporation had disproportionate distributions and applied for a private letter ruling to bless the fact that they were still going to be an S Corporation. So note, there is definitely an issue here that merely showing that we had disproportionate distributions by itself is not going to clobber our S election. Now that's important because, as I note, in this case, the taxpayer wants to have a holding that, in fact, there was no S corporation. The corporation was a C corporation for the years in question. Now, let's take a look at a bit of the background. The corporation here is LPP, and it was an S corporation. It was incorporated by Julian E. Long. It's important to keep the initials straight here because his son has the same first name but different middle initial, who is now deceased. But Julius E. Long, I should say, the father, now deceased, in 1975 formed this corporation. Shortly after the corporation elected S status. And Julian E.'s children, Julian W. Long, that was his son, and Linda Minton, his daughter, worked for the corporation. In the mid-1980s, the father ceased to be involved in the day-to-day operations of the business and became a consultant. He was never paid any amount that was labeled a salary by the corporation, but he did take distributions from time to time to pay living expenses for himself and his spouse. Although exactly how many shares were distributed and when was in dispute in another case, there's a battle going on in state court that goes around this particular case at the same time we have this tax court issue involving Linda Minton. When they transferred their shares to his children from Julian E. and perhaps his wife to the children, there's no question that the father's remaining interests were sold in equal parts to each child in September 1996, and he ceased to be a shareholder as of that day, leaving the siblings with controlling 100% of the stock. Well, as we discover, with 1999 being the year in litigation here, in a few years, these two shareholders weren't exactly seeing eye to eye, and in fact, some major disputes broke out during this time period. In fact, in state court litigation, there was a question of how many shares that Linda actually owned, and that dispute over the ownership of shares by Linda became the catalyst for the whole situation that would roll out here about whether or not there was an S corporation, or Linda's apparent concern or Linda's wish to have the S corporation election terminated. Now, the court noted that during the course of litigation in Louisiana state court, that was instituted by Linda against the corporation, her father and her brother, and others with regards to the LPP shares owned by her, her attorney discovered an audio tape of a purported 1986 LPP shareholders directors meeting attended by the father, the son, and the wife of the father. So mom, dad, son are in this meeting. Daughter is apparently not in this meeting. Her attorney, who was also her counsel in the tax court case, after listening to the tape and having it transcribed, advised Linda that the participants at the meeting, by providing for a fixed level of distributions to the father, had created a second class of stock in LPP. And thereby, it negated LPP's S-corporation status, effective in 1986 as of this meeting, when we created our second class of stock. Now, in a footnote to this, the court noted that in the actual case of Linda versus the company, the Court of Appeals held in Linda's favor and confirmed that she had purchased 19 shares of the stock in 86 and owned 50% of the stock in 1996, not 40.5%, as had been alleged by her father and her son. And it was reported on the 1998 Schedule K-1 that was issued to her by the partnership. Now, we don't know exactly who was alleged to own the 59.5%, but it probably wouldn't be surprising. I certainly wouldn't be shocked to discover that the position was that her brother, who was the president of the corporation, was the one deemed to have the controlling interest, and the battle was somewhat over whether he really did have the controlling interest in the corporation or whether, in fact, it was owned 50-50 by the two siblings. Now, Linda, of course, at this point now comes to the conclusion there's no longer an S corporation. So, of course, she went and did tax returns based upon the idea that there was no S corporation. So, as the court note, consistent with that position on her 1998 Form 1040, which she filed on or about November 15th of 99, okay, we filed a little late, she omitted $229,292 of the ordinary income and other pass-through items that reported on Schedule K-1, the shareholder share of income credits and deductions, issued to her for 1998. Now, notice, because of the fact that in state court she won the position she had 50%, the IRS went back and recalculated, and the actual amount in question now is $283,077, because, as the IRS would point out, well, if she owns 50%, it's an S corporation, she really should have been allocated more income. That's kind of the bad news to go with the good news that you won the case and you're a 50% shareholder. Along, though, with that 1998 return, she submitted an 8082, a Notice of Inconsistent Treatment or Administrative Adjustment Request, which justified the omission on the basis that the 86 agreement created a second class of stock in LPP, thereby causing it to lose its S-corporation status. Now, this is important because, of course, when we do disagree with an item reported on a pass-through, we are supposed to file this 8082. And I will note, not giving away hope in the answer too much about how this is going to turn out, you may have some suspicions about how it's going to turn out, but the fact that she raised that does mean the IRS was not asserting at trial that penalties were going to be applicable to Linda, at least for anything other than filing a return late. They were not asserting penalties on this position or the fact that there was negligence. She had fully disclosed what she was doing. That makes it important. Thereafter, she also filed amended 1996 and 97 returns, where she removed LPP earnings off of those returns and asked for a refund of her taxes. Now, the one issue was Linda may not have been thoroughly convinced that it was not an S corporation because she took an interesting step the next year. The court notes that on June 7th of 1999, she contributed one share of her LPP stock to HC Chemicals, Inc. Now, that's before she filed the 98 return, but obviously after the end of 98, and which she had been incorporated by her daughter on June 4th. Now, given the timing, it's not clear to me whether or not she did this after she'd already decided it was an S corporation, or where she did it first, believing this killed the S corp, then decided, aha, maybe it never was one, and went back to position two. But nevertheless, there's no question the corporation was killed as an S corporation, effective when she transferred the shares to HCC. Her daughter, Heather, became the president and sole shareholder of that company. And the sole function of that corporation was to hold corporation. Of course, having a corporate shareholder in an S corporation who holds anything less than 100% of the stock is going to make your S election cease as of that date. If you held 100%, we could be a qualifying S corporation subsidiary. But then again, no one ever suggested that HC Chemicals was an S corporation. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't, but it's not relevant because it didn't own more than one, it owned one share of the company. Now, as was noted in the case, the corporation on its income tax returns used the June 7th date as the date of the terminating event of the S status and filed essentially a short year S return through June 7th, allocating income to Linda, and then a C corporation return from that point forward. And of course, having this been done, the only way to get back to S status would be without IRS permission to wait 5 years, and even then they're going to have to get the unanimous consent of all shareholders. And at least if things have not calmed down a bit between the corporation's shareholders, the other shareholders, her brother and Linda, it may be difficult to get her consent at that point unless they get that consent as part of an overall agreement to settle all the rest of litigation. Now, as noted, the key question was the S Corporation status terminated in 1986 after that meeting, or did the status in fact stay in place all the way through June 7, 1999? Now, Linda's argument in favor of the termination date for 1986 was that the 86 agreement constituted a binding agreement within the meaning of the regulation section 1.1361-1L2I of the income tax regulations to make what she called guaranteed payments to the father, beginning in 86, whatever monthly amount be necessary to cover his and Alma's living expenses. And those payments were made over time and accounted for properly as state law dividends. And because nobody else received the monthly guaranteed payments that were received by the father, the corporation ceased to be an S corporation from the moment the agreement was made. Now, the court does note that this particular reg we're going to talk about here did not apply to agreements that were entered into before May 28, 1992 and were not modified after that date. No argument was made that that happened. However, since the reg provided that it could electively be applied by S corporations and their shareholders, the court went on to analyze the case as if, in fact, such an election was effectively being made by Linda having advanced this argument. So under that regulation, the key issue is whether such a binding agreement under state law, whether there was a binding agreement under state law, and whether that had the effect of creating a second class of stocks. Really two questions. Do we have a binding agreement? And if we have one, does that agreement create a second class of stock? The court would rule no on both issues eventually. First, let's go whether it was binding. The court noted that just to get started, they don't feel she established there was a binding agreement. At best, the court notes, she testified the agreement was nothing more than an informal oral understanding about the board members and shareholders of LPP to have LPP make monthly distributions to the father in whatever amounts he and his mother needed to cover their living expenses, a practice that was similar to what prevailed before 1986, before they became shareholders and before, you know, basically there's anybody but a single shareholder in the S Corporation. There is no evidence that the family members in their capacity as directors or shareholders of LPP took any formal corporate action to implement that understanding. And the court noted in a footnote that absent of corporate access is inconsistent with what appears to be the normal practice of the company to keep written minutes of directors and shareholders meetings and of all resolutions adopted at those meetings. So there was no record of this being formalized as the corporation had done for all other significant activities. Then it goes on to say, well, could this informal agreement have counted? And it decided under Louisiana law that you had to look at Louisiana corporate law, which specifically addresses the manner in which directors or shareholders of a Louisiana corporation can act on behalf of the corporation. Linda cited no provisions of the Louisiana corporate law and therefore no authority in support of her position that the corporation was in fact bound by this 86 agreement, with the result to say it would create a binding agreement. The court says its own review of Louisiana corporate law, since Linda didn't offer any, it went ahead and took a look at Louisiana law as understood it, led the court to conclude that the procedures required to institute a board of directors meeting and adopt binding resolutions are governed by either the articles of incorporation or the bylaws of the bylaws in the corporation or by Louisiana corporation law itself. The articles of incorporation don't address those meetings. And Linda never produced LPP's bylaws into evidence, so we don't have information about whether those would have done so. Nor did Linda demonstrate compliance with any provision of Louisiana laws that pertain to any of these procedures in the absence of bylaws or articles that would control otherwise. Therefore, it was held that effectively there was no binding agreement on the corporation. The court noted at best what she had done was said that the monthly distributions is, and when we look at the issue of, okay, were these in fact going to be, even if it's a binding agreement, did it create a second class of stock? And on that issue, when the court noted that the most that can be said the monthly distributions to the father is that they provided him with a timing benefit for their distributable earnings, which in total have not been shown to belong to the shareholders on other than a pro rata basis in accordance with the respective stock ownership percentages. The court also noted that actual distributions it found reported during those years were very roughly in accordance with the reported ownership of stock. The court specifically notes that the IRS gives an example in the regulations at regulations 1.361-1, L2 and VI, example 2, that tells us that distributions that differ only in timing do not create a second class of stock. In example 2, we have a corporation with two equal shareholders, A and B. Under the corporation's bylaws, A and B are entitled to equal distributions. The corporation distributes $50,000 to A in the current year, but doesn't distribute $50,000 to B until 1 year later. The circumstances indicate that the difference in timing did not occur by reason of a binding agreement related to distribution or liquidation proceeds. And it held in that case, there is no second class of stock created under the regulations. So the court held that Linda fails on both counts. She fails to show a binding agreement, and she fails to show that, in fact, there was a second class of stock related to this, that the very fact that distributions may have been somewhat different in timing would have created a second class of stock, perhaps even if we had had some sort of, even in fact, this arrangement had been deemed to be a binding arrangement on the corporation. The court also is concerned that she takes inconsistent positions in litigation in state court versus what she's claiming here. In the federal tax court, she's claiming that everything that came out of here were distributions or dividends on the stock of the various shareholders. But in state court, the question arose of whether Linda had purchased shares. And at state court, she took the position and testified that, in fact, these extra distributions to her father were meant to pay off her note to her father for the purchase of the shares of stock. Now, the tax court is saying, look, you can't have it both ways. You can't tell me, one, they're distributions, but then, two, they're being used to pay your debt. You know, those distributions you claim create a second class of stock when you were in another venue, when it would benefit you to claim they were something else, you had taken the inconsistent position there that those distributions were really made on your behalf to pay for your purchase of stock from Julian. Based upon that testimony against her own interest in this case, the court held essentially that they were not going to believe her testimony here that these represented distributions, therefore denying her relief on that position as well. Now, let's take a look and let's get to some conclusions based on this case. It's important to note the results may very well have been different if it had been the IRS examining this corporation and trying to decide if there were two classes of stock. In that case, the court's probably been more, amenable to a belief that son, daughter, and dad had a side binding agreement among themselves, kind of an informal agreement, that in fact dad was going to get extra distributions from the corporation. In essence, his stock had more important rights than the kid's stock. As well, the IRS obviously could have required the production of the bylaws of the corporation to show whether in fact maybe there was something in the bylaws that would have rendered this particular meeting into a binding meeting. But the real problem Linda had was she had gone along with this all during this period. Now, the court did not address the question that the IRS raised as their secondary argument on this point, that even if the court found there was a binding agreement that would have created a second class of stock, the mere fact that Linda had agreed to this and filed returns consistent with that position for all these years meant that she was basically stopped, due to the duty of consistency, from arguing in this case that the S Corporation election was invalid. That was not an argument she'd be allowed to make. The court didn't rule on that matter since it pointed out, didn't need to rule on that matter since it already ruled that even if it granted that this agreement, you know, even if it granted that she could take an inconsistent position, it did not find that she had proven this particular arrangement created a second class of stock in any event and terminated the S election. Having ruled that, it didn't worry about the duty of consistency. However, the duty of consistency will be important. It is very difficult, we must remember, to ever try to argue against a position where we were involved in taking that position, or we have essentially adopted that position and agreed to it, especially in this case, for what amounted to almost a decade worth of income tax returns before one morning we suddenly had the revelation that this was no longer an S corporation and now we want an inconsistent treatment, even though obviously it appears Linda was aware of the fact that distributions were being made to her dad. And it should have occurred to her that maybe that was, you know, if there was going to raise an issue about the S Corporation distributions, the question arises, why did she suddenly wait until it was to her advantage to make this, to raise this question? If you try that, you're likely to find the courts aren't going to be sympathetic. But it's also important to note that Linda did succeed in killing this S election. It appears that for whatever reason, there weren't provisions in place that were effective in stopping Linda from transferring ownership of a share of stock to a corporation. Now, in the absence of buy sells, restrictions on the stock, and all those other issues that we talk about as being very necessary in an S corporation, and when I did S corp courses this year, I certainly mentioned that I thought it was crucial that you've got to have this because it's so easy to kill an S election. In the absence of that, it was very easy when Linda got in litigation and it served her purposes to get rid of the S election. Whether that was due to the fact that there really was an advantage to her, you know, perhaps the facts were, we're not sure what exactly they were, but perhaps Son and Dad were just trying to squeeze her out by having the corporation generate income, but, you know, dry up the distributions from this point forward. So Linda was picking up six figures worth of income from the S corporation, but was given no cash to pay the tax. That could be used as an incentive to get you to sell the stock to the corporation. We also have to face the possibility that it's conceivable Linda was just upset with her brother and her dad and simply wanted to do something she knew they wouldn't like. While I don't know anything about Linda and don't know for sure if she would go that way, I have certainly seen family fights and family issues where the party simply got to the point of wanting to do damage to the other side and weren't terribly concerned about what happened to themselves as long as the other party suffered. In any event, it's crucial to have restrictions that force the sale back of the S Corp stock if, in fact, the stock ever gets in the hands of an entity not qualified to be an S Corporation shareholder. It's also very crucial that I think the final deal is, obviously, Dad's succession plan to have son and daughter run the business and have joint ownership moving forward didn't seem to quite work. Many times when we counsel our clients about succession planning, we need to take a hard look at whether, in fact, their beliefs and their concepts are realistic. In essence, is it fairly clear that the two kids aren't going to get along? It's also pretty clear, to be honest, going forward in many cases, that, in fact, you're not going to discover how well they get along until you really turn them loose in the corporation, have them start running things. And usually there are two crises. The one appears to occur here when Dad, in fact, it appears that things really moved away and the sales took place, and it would appear these things happened. In fact, it appears it may have been Mom's death that may have triggered this whole incident. Or it can happen when Dad finally dies and we no longer have the parents to referee between the parties. But in any event, you need to understand what happens if things go wrong. And sometimes you need to have the conversation with your clients. What if the kids don't get along? What's going to happen? They may not believe they won't get along, but I've been through too many cases where kids who Mom and Dad thought would have no trouble getting along after they passed on, we discovered that once the second parent dies or even the first parent dies, suddenly we discover all these issues and all these fights among the children. You need to be careful there. Now, this has been the Tax Update for December 31st, 2007. The Tax Update is brought to you by Limeburg Information Services, located on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. We'll be talking to you in the new year here shortly, so get ready, have a happy new year, a good 2008, and tax season is almost upon us. And this has been the Tax Update.